Nerds and geeks, hold on to your seats because it's about to go down.
Welcome to Nerdorama, the voice of the Nerd Nation. I'm Mo Kelly, he's Tawala Sharp, and together we bring you your daily dose of nerd news, analysis, and conversations with the best and brightest of the nerdverse.
If that ain't me, you can be the hero.
New York Times bestselling author Michael Northrup reteams with artist Gustavo Duarte to debut Dear DC Super Villains. This is the sequel to the creative duo's smash hit Dear Justice League, which was so innovative and so ingenious. While Dear Justice League featured the world's greatest superheroes answering fan mail from young fans, well, Dear DC Super Villains features the Legion of Doom answering questions from curious kids, and it makes you wonder how that might go. Well, it's hilarious, and it's for kids, and it hits stores everywhere. April 6th, Michael Northrup joins me right now via Zoom. Michael, first, how are you, sir, as we come out of this pandemic? How you been?
Not too bad. Obviously, this is a very different conversation than the last time. But yeah, pretty good. The weather's improving. I got my first shot, so I'm feeling pretty good.
Me as well. I'm waiting on the second shot, and it's interesting how it changes your whole outlook on things as far as where the country is going. It actually brings a smile to my face, the idea of getting back to a degree of normalcy. But first, let me start with, I mentioned it in my introduction, why do you think Dear Justice League was such a tremendous hit, which set up Dear DC Supervillains?
Well, you know, it was just a book that Gustavo and I had a tremendous amount of fun putting together. And I think that sort of came through in the finished product. It was really just a love letter to these classic, iconic superheroes and a way to sort of approach them more as people and less as sort of larger than life figures. And I think that that was, you know, an easy thing for a lot of people to get on board with. Kind of a love letter to these characters who, for so many of us, we've known them longer than anyone outside of our immediate family. You might know Superman, right? Batman, Wonder Woman, these characters, you know, you could be dressing up as them for Halloween at age 3, you know what I mean? And and your whole life, you have some sort of relationship with these characters. And so just an opportunity to, on the one hand, go back to sort of the beginning of kid-friendly, kind of retro, kind of sunny idea of these characters, but also to sort of approach them from a whole different angle, you know, that you probably never have thought about them before. I think that was a lot of fun for people. And, you know, I know it was a lot of fun, for me.
To your point, yes, we grow up thinking and dreaming of being a superhero, maybe being Superman, maybe being Batman, Green Lantern, what have you. But I don't know if kids, or at least I didn't grow up thinking about, oh, let me be Sinestro, or let me be MODOK, or you know what I mean? Just in the sense of considering what goes on in the mind of those individuals, if you will, was it a hard sell to pitch the idea of, hey, we're going to do the same thing, but we're going to do it with the villains, and it's going to be funny, and it's going to be for kids? Was there any difficulty in pitching that?
You know, there really wasn't. And part of it is, by the way, I love the fact that your mind immediately went to MODOK. You know
what I mean? Yeah, and I'm sorry. That's just me.
Not the first villain a lot of people would think of, but like, that's like, mine went to Grodd. You know what I mean? So it's just like, it's true. Like, it's a different relationship between kids and heroes and between kids and villains, but it's still very strong. And, you know, sort of like we mentioned there, sort of very personal. You gravitate towards the ones you gravitate towards for your own reasons. And the heroes really, they aren't the same without the villains, right? So what the villains bring is the other side, you know what I mean, of the equation that allows the heroes to, you know, to shine. But what they also bring is something different. If the heroes for kids, you know, they represent, you know, this like excitement, this aspiration, things like that. What the villains represent is your little bit of electricity, that little bit of excitement. And it's a fun thing to think about, you know what I mean? Like how that would take shape in a book and how it would be different. So people were on board. I mean, it was sort of like was a really logical next step. Heroes first, and now the villains. And then the question becomes, well, how is this book going to be different? You know, how does that change the equation?
Yeah, I wonder, do the questions change more than the answers? I believe a child, if I'm thinking back to when I was maybe 5, 6, 7 years old, the child's innocence doesn't necessarily change, but the types of answers which may come back would definitely change. Or do they not change?
It was really interesting when I really, you know, sat down and really started thinking about that both sides of that coin changed. You know, the kids, first of all, you know, like the kids writing to the Justice League in Dear Justice League, very earnest, you know, open-hearted, sharing sort of like either really blunt questions or really heartfelt ones. But, you know, for example, using their full names, not afraid to share with these heroes. With supervillains, it's like, well, would you even give them your real name or your full name? You know what I mean? So we've got, you know, some anonymous letters. We've got people using just a last initial. It's much more guarded. If you think about what would it be like to contact Sinestro, right? You know, like much more cautious. And instead of earnestness, there's a curiosity there, but it's a very different feel from the kids. They may be curious what makes these bad guys tick, but also cautious. They don't want to share too much. They don't want to anger them. And then when you think about the villains, how they would answer, they answer in ways that demonstrate why they're villains in a sense, right? There's some pettiness in this. some dishonesty,
jealousy, maybe.
Jealousy. So it all comes out, right? So they, like, these kids ask some innocent questions, but it scratches something in the villains that is maybe not that innocent. They're like, they're jealous of Lex, they're you know, things like that. It was really fun to have questions that sort of like got at something about the villains, you know, like, and in some cases the villains don't answer honestly, but it's not because they're trying to, you know, lie to the kids. They're not being honest with themselves. Like, they don't see themselves quite accurately.
Absolutely. Most of the villains see themselves as the hero of their own story, and they attribute altruistic reasons for what they do. It does speak to the psychology of it all. And how did you know that you were hitting the right note in the answers? Were you like testing them with kids, or were you like crowdsourcing questions from kids?
It was a question of trying to, you know, find the right formula for the book as a whole. So each question doesn't have to get at absolutely everything about the villain, but it has to like expose something specific about that villain that, you know, sort of like lets you in a little bit on who they are or why they are that way. So it's a question of like finding questions that a kid would ask, but that would illuminate something specific about and something different about each character. And in terms of like coming up with the questions, you know, I think I've mentioned before, but I worked at Sports Illustrated Kids magazine for 12 years. And one of the things we did is, you know, I interviewed dozens, I don't know, maybe hundreds of athletes, right? And sometimes we had kids, readers, send in questions for them. And you start to notice patterns, you know, the things that young fans are interested in about these larger than life figures, you know, and the opportunity to ask them something. And, you know, there's a short jump between, you know, an athlete is, you know, a larger than life figure with superhuman abilities and a hero, and in some cases a villain, depending on which athlete we're talking about. Right. And so, right. So it was just a question of that, like thinking back to what these young readers would ask star athletes when they had a chance. If you told them you have a chance just to ask this one athlete one question, what would it be? And you definitely notice patterns. And so I sort of just thought back to that a lot and then tried to come up with a good mix that would make for a fun book, but also illustrate different aspects of different villains.
How much of yourself, or not at all, did you put yourself into this book? Was there a question that you had possibly from your childhood that you wanted to ask a DC supervillain like a Gorilla Grodd or a Harley Quinn or any one of those villains that you wanted to ask and also answer?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's just probably there's a little bit of my own curiosity in all of those questions, right? Because like I'm coming up with, you know, a list of possible questions for each one. And it's like, which one does my eye catch on when I'm looking down that list? Which one makes the final cut? And that is probably, you know, if I'm being honest, just the one that is most personally interesting to me. With one exception, which is the one that's most personally interesting to me, or the one I think Gustavo would have the most fun drawing. You know what I mean? Like, so there's some of him in here too. But yeah, I think that's part of it. It's just because I became the filter for these questions. And it's like, what fascinates me about villains? And, you know, villains, in a sense, are kind of, in a lot of cases, they're the most interesting part of the story. You know, like the heroes, you understand them maybe a little more readily, a little more naturally. The villains, it's like, why? You know, like, why do you do this? You have all this power, these gifts, and this is what you choose to do. You know what I mean? Like, but there's also, again, that electricity. The example I think of a lot with this is the first time we see Darth Vader in, you know, the first Star Wars movie. You've never seen him before. And in fact, you've like never seen anything like that before.
No backstory either. He's just introduced.
He just introduced, but he'd like, they blow down the door. He steps into that hallway and it's like, who is this? You know what I mean? Like, he's like all in black. He's breathing heavy. He's huge, physically huge. You know, this is a bad dude without any back. You don't need it. You just like sit up in your seat and you're like, wait a second. Who is this? And how is anyone ever going to stop him? You know what I mean? And there's that electricity that it brings. And that's what I wanted to capture a little bit, that excitement, that electricity, even though you know they're the bad guys, you know, like you sort of can't take your eyes off them. And that's what I wanted to get at here.
We live in this world now where it is becoming increasingly cool, my word, to be associated with the villain. The villain is getting a little more sunlight these days. Yes. In a cinematic standpoint, you have movies like Harley Quinn. You have movies like Joker and so forth. And on the Marvel side, you have movies like Venom, disconnected from their superhero counterpart. So with that in mind, how did you go about choosing which villains were going to be in Dear DC Supervillains?
Well, yeah, it's something I gave a lot of thought to. It started with the anti-hero, right? With all of a sudden now it's like Wolverine is the X-Men that everyone wants to talk about, you know, like, you know, Deadpool, things like that, where you're talking about the heroes with an edge.
Yeah, right? They're not good guys. They're not good people.
Exactly, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's like the fine line between bad boys and bad guys, right? Like,
right.
Like it's, but it started with that, like, oh, he's like a hero, but he's got an edge. He's a little dangerous. And then those anti-heroes got less and less heroic, essentially. And then you just get to the point where it's just straight up villains are the main characters. You know what I mean? Like, and so with this, it's a little bit retro in that sense. It's a little bit sunnier. The villains, I want them to be compelling characters. I want you to understand what they're thinking, but I don't want them to be the heroes, right? So with Justice League, what you saw is teamwork working together, you know, people making up for each other's weak points with their own strengths. What you see in Dear Supervillains is teamwork not working so great. You know what I mean? Like a team that has all this power, all this like incredible abilities, but they just can't quite gel.
Can we be honest? Legion of Doom should have beat Justice League 9 times out of 10. That's what I think.
100%, right? And I mean, not to give too much away, but they had like a big advantage in that fight. And it's just like, they should have won.
They should have had
the superior, but they didn't. And why didn't they? Because of this like competitiveness, the inability to communicate, you know, like pulling in different directions. There's that one scene towards the end where, you know, Wonder Woman's like, remember, we're stronger when we stick together. And the Legion of Doom's like, everyone split up. You know, and it's just like, without hitting the nail too precisely on the head, but it's like, it's something I wanted to do. I mean, these villains are flawed individuals, and the heroes are imperfect, but the villains are flawed in ways that both explains their villainy and is explained by their villainy. And so it's something I wanted to do. I wanted to put together a team of villains, but not a seamless, you know, Swiss watch machine of a team. I wanted a team that's pulling in different directions, a team that's got different priorities, very different personalities. And then you can see that these are fun characters, they're powerful characters, but there's a reason that the Justice League wins at the end of the day. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to show compelling, understandable characters without making them the hero of the story.
Dear DC Supervillains is out on April 6th, but I'm quite sure people would like to stay in touch with you and continue the conversation, find out any other titles. How could they go about doing that?
First of all, thanks so much. Secondly, I'm on Twitter probably most of the time. That's MD Northrup. And then I'm on Instagram a little less often, but those two. And then I got my website is michaelnorthrup.net. because someone got the .com, and every year I try and get it back, and every year I can't. But so michaelnorthrup.net, at MD Northrup on Twitter. Those are probably your best bets. Yeah, definitely follow along.
The name of the book, as you know, Dear DC Supervillains. Ask your favorite villain some questions, but from the perspective of a young child, I think it's brilliant, its formulation, and I hope to see more of that. I'm curious to know where it leads from here. Maybe the sidekicks are next?
I mean, that would be, you know.
I'll give that one to you for free, okay? I won't even, yeah, I won't even copyright that. You won't have to pay for that.
Yeah, I appreciate. Actually, you know what? The owner of my local comic store was the first person to say that to me, and it just like lit up a lot of things in my head. But from your lips to DC's ears, right? So.
Well, Michael Northrup, thank you so much for coming back on, and we wish you nothing but the best, and we will be talking again soon.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you again. Really appreciate it.
Hello and welcome to the BiPow, the only online comic book review column that's a stitch away from making it and a scar away from falling apart. My name is Hannibal Taboo. You can find everything you'd like to know about me using @HANNI, B as in bounce, A-L, T as in tough, A, B as in bounce, U. That could be on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, MySpace, Black Planet, Plurk, the inside of your mama's Geritol can, and everywhere that you'd like to be. These are reviews for books that came out on March 31st, 2021. The first section of our reviews is called The BiPow. It's for books that are so good they demand to be purchased on the spot, or they're from a series that has had at least 3 issues in a row that have been worth purchasing and will stay there until there are 3 issues in a row that are not. I'm sorry to report there's nothing there this week, and I'm going to be honest with you, that's a bad sign. Let's move on. The second section of our reviews is called Honorable Mentions. It's for books that were good, but maybe not exactly enough goodness imbued in their pages to divest you of your cash therein. There, we find Black Cat number 4 from Marvel Comics with the creative team of Jed McKay, Nina Vacueva, Brian Raber, and Farron Delgado. As a delightful little side quest, Felicia Hardy has accidentally inspired a would-be arch rival that's just competent enough to be interesting, but not on the level of a Spider-Man that would make it a whole thing. This is not immediately relevant to the long-term storyline here. Many years before, a young heiress was kidnapped and brainwashed. She got the whole Manson family treatment, becoming a villain, then becoming conditioned as a hero called the Queen Cat, all of which was not very noteworthy. Now, for reasons that are ultimately unimportant, the Queen Cat has the idea that she has a nemesis, and that taking down the Black Cat would legitimize her in the public eye. The interesting part is how the Queen Cat lingered on the periphery of events through the whole series, which is a very interesting Rashomon swing for this issue that gives Queen Cat an immediate hook. Unfortunately, the character at the focal point here is uninspiring. Her desperation for external validation, both her raison d'etre and her Achilles heel, making her an element that is impossible to find favorable. From visual design to dialogue, making Queen Cat into a thing is only helped by circumstance and not by anything intrinsic. Like buying a box of chocolate candies and finding one with nothing inside, there are good elements to this work, and hopefully as things continue, Queen Cat can grow into somebody who's more than a poor derivative. So that rating would be honorable mention. The next section of our reviews is called The Meh Pal, for books that, I mean, they happened. I mean, you know, there was good stuff, there was bad stuff, but overall, you honestly probably won't remember a lot of it. There we found stuff like Future State Superman vs. Imperious Lex number 3. We found scrolling. Captain America number 28, even though, I gotta tell you, right-wing Twitter is pretty up in arms about it. It's just not that interesting a book. That part was funny, though, but we're not gonna get into it. X-Men number 19, King in Black, Return of the Valkyries, number 4, yada, 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 meh, meh, meh. All forgettable, none of which you'll care about in 5 seconds after I stop talking. The last section of our reviews is called No, Just No, and it's for books that are abjectly terrible and should not be purchased under any circumstance. And I'm sorry to tell you there are two books there. Let's dig in. The first is Flash number 768 from DC Comics with the creative team of Jeremy Adams, Brandon Peterson, Marco Santucci, and David LaFuente. With all the grace and forgiveness of a police officer giving slack to a mass murderer, this baffling issue offers the central spotlight of the title to Wally West after he committed 10 murders and tried to frame 2 innocent people for it. With that as a starting point, it's little surprise that this issue continued on a downward slope. Let's start with the opening scene. A discussion between Barry Allen, Oliver Queen, and Wally West as the latter has decided to give up superheroing. For some reason, Superman, Hawkgirl, and Naomi were standing around, largely in formation, for virtually no reason. Batman has one line, but otherwise looks like he's contemplating his tax liability. Superman bothers to have a surprised look at one point, Hawkgirl looks bored, Naomi has no expression at all, it's all a hot mess that accomplished nothing. Then, Wally and Barry have a race that makes sense in the narrative, sort of, but for some reason starts out on a busy city street. There's a nod to Future State as one of them needs a ride and the other gets lost, and the whole sequence of events has a lot of big splashy action and next to no logic. None of this can be blamed on the visual team, as Brandon Peterson, Marco Santucci, and David LaFuente make dinosaurs, machine guns, volcanic eruptions, Paris, a super science lab, a jungle, and more look absolutely gorgeous. Sadly, Jeremy Adams' script must bear the brunt of this, as Oliver Queen plays the dumb role to keep the exposition coming, multiple heroes lose their powers, and it's possible that Wally West killed the dinosaurs. It's gibberish, frankly, and that's before you remember that this is all focused on a spree killer. Yeah, hard to say anything else for this. That rating would be no, just no. The last book we're going to review today is Strange Adventures number 9 from DC Comics with the creative team of Tom King, Mitch Gerards, Evan Shaner, and Clayton Cowles. The central thesis of this issue purports that Adam Strange is a hero. This argument, put forth by the kind of westernized talking heads that claim that the pandemic would be over already, is one from a position of bad faith and rhetorical fallacies, and as such, the narrative takes it on the chin. The Justice League released an investigative report compiled over many issues created by Mr. Terrific, who learned an alien language along the way and had militarized Rannians try to kill him. The report implies that Adam Strange committed essentially war crimes in a Rannian struggle against a largely undefeated extraterrestrial race called the Picts. For context, the Picts have apparently attacked Phoenix, Arizona in a kind of a first strike. Adam's Lady Macbethish wife, Alana, finds this report a mild inconvenience. "We've gotten through worse, Rann knows." Despite this essentially kicking Adam out of the league. Adam, however, is incensed and goes to Batman and Superman for answers that they do not have in return. The bad faith argument put forth by Alana and subsequently a pair of pundits called Ellie and Brian, speaking from positions of privilege and experience, is this. Brian, you have to focus on the essential, especially now. Ellie, do we need a man like Adam? Brian, I think so. Ellie, so do I. They go on to say, I don't know much, but I know I trust whoever hates the Picts the most. Ellie, it's now clear as night as day. Now let's remember Adam, a fairly ordinary guy with a gun and a jetpack comparatively, was the sole arguably extra-normal operative in this science fiction war, and he was just barely above average. That's what the situation was on Rann. On Earth, by comparison, at any given time, there are 3 or 4 Kryptonian-class bruisers flying around, 7 Shazams, 6 Green Lanterns, at least 3 Speedsters, Wonder Woman, Martian Manhunter, and the template from multiple universes worth of terror, Batman. Adam Strange isn't even the best prepared or most dangerous person in this comic book, let alone on the planet. So this overwhelming show of confidence for him is at best baffling, and at worst, the disingenuous ranting of liars. Can characters lie? Sure. Could even Alana put forth an intentional lie? Maybe. However, this almost bizarro-scented presentation of, quote-unquote, the report and the Justice League will let the Earth fall to a fairly homogenous group of aggressors who don't even have a single speedster, after Darkseid has been put on his back multiple times, presented as fact by people who should theoretically not be locked up in Arkham, is just no. How are these guys worse than Thanagar, which at least had a grillion jerks who could fly and use magic space metal? Once we get by that, let's deal with the actual issues of the plot. The events of this issue, as many previous, happen in multiple time periods. In the past, Adam deploys chemical weapons and clandestine tactics to kill a lot of Picts. Okay. In the present, Adam takes a call, flies around, and is mad at his friends while Mr. Terrific broods. Alana goes on TV, and the everyday chaos of superheroics happen. That's it. That's the book. There's no design that everyone who worked on the book has literally created dazzling, wonder-inducing content in the past. There's no denying that everybody who worked on this knows how to make the heck out of a comic book. This ain't it. There are flaws in conception and execution, and more importantly, intent. Who profits from putting forth this kind of quote-unquote alternative facts perspective played straight? What is gained by another hero of feet and maybe shins and possibly even thighs at this point of clay? Aaliyah Strange deserves better, and frankly, so do you. The rating is no, just no. With two really bad books and nothing to really recommend this week, it's kind of rough out there in these tweets. Let's try next week and see if we can do better. I'm, as always, grateful to Mo and Tawala for having me here. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to speaking with you next time.
Hey guys, Mo Kelly here. The new daily Nerdorama podcast is featured on iHeartRadio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast feed to get your daily dose of nerd news. Also available on iTunes, Spreaker, and all the top podcasting apps. It's free and perfect for everyone in your nerd family.
Nerdorama is produced by Tawala Sharp and continues to be a segment on The Mo Kelly Show. Weekends on KFI Los Angeles. Hit us up on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Nerdorama News.
Until next time, keep it comic.